Episode 1133, Hop to the Top with Oppenheimer.
It did hop to the top.
Exactly. Just won Best Picture.
Welcome to the Sci-Fi Christian, bringing you theology at warp speed. I'm Matt Anderson.
I'm Ben DiBono. We're back.
We're back to talk about the 2023 best movie of the year, according to the Oscars.
Yeah, and I haven't seen all the, you know, all the stuff from 2023, but I would say I think they made a great choice.
I'm right now asking Google, how many Oscars did Oppenheimer win? Seven.
Yeah, won quite a bit.
Let's just see here.
I know.
Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, yeah. Best Supporting Actor, and I don't have that.
They just Cillian Murphy and Robert Downey Jr. I think it won Best Score and Best Editing.
Oh, yeah. I remember you made a point to mention to me that it had Best Editing.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about the editing, but so
Best Cinematography?
Yeah.
Nailed it.
I watched this movie in theaters, and then I rewatched it a little over a week ago, and I think I enjoyed it even more the second time. I'm honestly in awe of what Christopher Nolan has accomplished with this movie.
It should have been in awe of Oppenheimer.
Oh.
But it's too late. We are hopping to the top.
Well, we got the rhyme.
Tell me more, because I think you mentioned to me before. No, we talked last week, and you had already watched it a second time. And I think you mentioned you liked it even more, and you wondered how I would feel on the first time viewing. So yeah. Let's not tell my review or my rating yet.
Right, right, right.
But tell me why, what made it better? I have some guesses on what I would have liked better, but go ahead.
I mean, I do think that it can be a little hard to follow the first time because of the jumping around in the chronology. I think it was just, I don't know. I mean, I loved it the first time too. So it's not as though, well, it was okay. Now this time I love it. No, it's like I loved it both times.
You gave it 5 stars both times?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. I think that, just it's a movie where you can settle into, it has a rhythm to it. It has a flow to it. That's very, very impressive. I think that, biopics are hard to do right. They can be very, very dry, and they can just kind of drone on and on and have these familiar beats. And even though it does make it a little bit hard to follow, the way Christopher Nolan has this constructed with, you're following really three different timelines mm-hmm. throughout this. You've got...
Wait, there's three?
Yeah.
I thought there was two. There's the in color version and the black and white version.
No, there's the Los Alamos bomb leading up to and beyond the Trinity test. You have
And then
the
his
security clearance hearing.
Yep, okay.
And then you have the Senate.
I'm with you.
Confirmation.
I'm with you.
And but, arguably but there's four, because then within the Senate confirmation, you're hearing the backstory of Strauss and Oppenheimer's relationship at Princeton.
But every time it's in the black and white, that's Strauss's point of view, right? That's the conceit there.
Yes. Okay. And you know, so one thing that I think helped with the timeline is I have read the book that this is based on.
Okay.
American Prometheus, which is excellent, highly recommended, and that does go chronologically, and so it does help you to make sense of it. But I do think that even though, if you haven't read the book and you're not familiar with Oppenheimer, yes, there's areas where you're going to get confused about what's taking place when. I don't think it entirely matters, because the film does such a good job of I think I compared it to Tree of Life a little bit, where Tree of Life has this narrative, but it's really more about getting inside the narrative and the flow with it. And I think Christopher Nolan does such a great job in this movie in getting you inside the characters and inside the ideas and making it this experience, in the way that scenes flow into each other. It's like what you're used to is that we're going to have the music for this scene, then we cut to the next scene. And here you have scenes across timelines flowing into each other, and the music just keeps going, and it just drags you along from scene to scene to scene. I want to talk more about the editing as we get into this, but the way this film is edited is a huge challenge, but it is profoundly great the way this film flows together. It's an incredible achievement.
I'll just cut to the chase. I gave it 4 stars. And it seems like you feel disappointed in that rating.
Yeah, it's a little light.
Even though I said I liked it. I enjoyed it. Gave it 4 stars. Not my favorite Christopher Nolan film, but not everything could be Batman.
I mean...
Just kidding. Yeah. You know what my favorite... If I was to actually rank them, I don't have it in front of me, but I think Prestige is my favorite of his films.
Yeah. I mean, you know.
But this is your favorite now, Nolan?
It's definitely his best movie.
Okay.
I think that, and we could talk about like the favorite versus best, but on a purely technical filmmaking level, I would defend this as objectively his best film. And I don't think it's close, to be honest. Now, there are other movies that depend on the mood I'm in. I mean, this is, of course, a three-hour commitment, and so you have a lot of that, where this might not be, you know, his most rewatchable or exciting or entertaining movie, though I think it is all of those things. It is objectively his best movie. And it's like, and coming off of his worst movie, I mean, Tenet is bad. I've rewatched it. It's not good.
I think Insomnia is worse.
Oh, I completely disagree.
I think Following is worse.
Totally disagree. Both of those are towards the bottom of his filmography. Following, you know, it's his first full-length movie. You can see him playing around with ideas. I think there's some interesting things going in there, and you can see his voice emerging. Insomnia is a remake. I like the cast. I like a lot of what's going on with the kind of cat and mouse. It's not as good as the original film. But both of those are decent movies. I think Tenet is just a mess.
Nolan has two films I've only watched once, both in the theater, both with you, that I'd like to rewatch: Dunkirk and Tenet. I've only seen both of those once.
I love Dunkirk.
Yeah.
Yeah, Dunkirk is good. And you can see a little bit of what he's doing with Dunkirk as kind of a trial run up to Oppenheimer. They're both historical. They both kind of have his way of bringing in the whole time thing, mm-hmm. you know, that he's obsessed with time. But in Oppenheimer, it's so much more successful, and I love Dunkirk, but it's so much more successful. He allows his interest to come into the movie, but they don't take over the movie.
Well, instead of making it about messing with time, he has a clock ticking for the whole film.
Yeah.
Like, literally in the soundtrack, there's a ticking clock.
Yes.
This is fun to talk about, just as a side note. Tell me more about, I mean, I understand a little of what you're saying, but when you say he's obsessed with time and he plays with that, tell me more. I know some of what you mean, but I just want to hear it from you.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of his movies, just about, maybe excepting the Dark Knight movies.
Yeah, no Batman.
Though you could say he's intercutting some of them, but yeah, that's cheap. But like Memento, you have the backwards
right.
thing. I guess Insomnia really doesn't, but again, that's a remake. And I think he was a director for Hire. I don't think he wrote the script.
Let me just give it. I'll give you the movies in no particular order. So you said Insomnia, not really. Following. Is there time stuff in there?
I don't recall. I haven't seen it enough.
Interstellar, yes, of course. And Interstellar is one that I feel like it's a slow burn for me over years. Like, I've seen it multiple times. I bet I've seen it three times.
Yeah, I love Interstellar.
And I just keep liking it more and more.
Yeah, it's really, really good.
All right, Dunkirk, we talked about the clock. Tenet, obviously, time travel.
Insomnia, or not Insomnia, Inception.
Inception, that's just about how, yeah, I guess there is.
Oh, yeah, Inception totally does. You have,
dream time?
That whole, the last hour of the movie, you have three different timelines going on. It's incredible.
What about Prestige? Is that just showing different parts of that's more like flashbacks and stuff, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's Prestige less so.
Okay. Wow. Yeah.
So. But yeah, he keeps coming back to this idea of time and chronology and all of that. And I think that, like, Tenet is part of what makes that movie bad, is that he allows his interest to just take over the movie. Mm-hmm. Whereas here, you have the ticking clock. You have the, you know, told out of chronological order. But it's all in service of the film. Like, this movie is all about getting into the psychology and the headspace of Robert Oppenheimer. And it does a tremendously great job of that. And so all of this out of context stuff, you have Strauss with his obsession with, oh, this conversation between Einstein mm-hmm. and Oppenheimer, and the way it just dive bombs his career. You have, you have the confirmation hearing and the flashbacks to that. You have one of my favorite out of context things that I love is you have this great scene where after the Trinity test, Oppenheimer's speaking to the auditorium of the Los Alamos people, mm-hmm. and they're stomping their feet in anticipation yes. for him, and it's. His speech that he gives in the movie is historically accurate. It's kind of this awkward, clumsy moment for him that would stand in contrast to the later regrets that he had. And the movie does such a good job about that because, and this is one of the things I think that did make it better on the second time, is that the stomping of the feet in the auditorium builds for like 20 minutes before you get there. You start to hear that.
And you see even flashes of that scene.
Yes, and you don't know what it is. And then you realize it's this seminal moment where he kind of embraces his celebrity of being the father of the bomb, you know, and then later comes to regret the enthusiasm that he had in that moment. And so it's this sort of crossroads moment in his life. And so the way that Christopher Nolan's able to, we're not at that point in the story, but I'm going to flash back and have those moments of the foot stomping and everything is really, really, really good.
Yeah, I could see where he was doing because you and I watch a lot of film and we've seen a lot of Christopher Nolan. When I saw that flashing, I knew, okay, this is going to connect. Whatever he's feeling now will be amplified in a later scene where we see whatever this is.
Yes. Let's talk about the performances. Cillian Murphy and Robert Downey Jr. both won for this, and they both deserve it. I think super impressive, but Robert Downey Jr. is so good.
Mm-hmm.
Astralis, it's just this obsession that he has.
Yeah, did it make you want to rewatch Iron Man?
You know, his whole filmography.
Yeah, just keep going.
But I mean, like, even in the MCU, he's a good actor, but this is, I think that as his MCU career went on, he kind of got pigeonholed into this, you know, smart aleck,
mm-hmm.
you know, he's got this snappy demeanor, always, you know, the one-liners and everything. This is a totally different role. And I think he kind of disappears into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I didn't remember that he was in the movie the first time I saw it. So you're sitting there like, is that Robert Downey Jr.? That is Robert Downey Jr.
Okay.
He's so good at it, too. Totally deserves his Oscar win. Cillian Murphy just, kills it.
Wow.
Throughout the whole film. And the way that he sells his facial expressions. And I think the final moment of the film is one of my favorites where you realize what he said to Einstein in this conversation, and then you get the flash of the world blowing up, and just his facial expression in this. But then the way he's able to, because Oppenheimer, one of the things you get from American Prometheus is that this was a very, very complex man. And he's part of the tragedy of his career is that he was constantly trying to, people were constantly trying to pigeonhole him into things. Like all the communist stuff, he went to these causes, but without ever being a communist, he just had some things about him he liked. And everybody wanted to, are you a communist? Are you not a communist? And he was a more complex person than that. And so he just kind of, like, he didn't realize the implications of what he was doing. He was very naive in certain ways. Mm-hmm. And then a genius in other ways. And then a mess of his home life and everything. And I think that Cillian Murphy just nails all these aspects of his character.
I was just looking up his filmography because I remember him being around a lot in the early 2000s and then less so, and then maybe popping up here and there, but he hasn't been a constant presence. I know he did some television, some prestige series, that kind of thing.
Blinders. Peaky Blinders.
I mean, this is going to put him back on the map. I mean, now, I'm not saying he's been gone. He's been around, but I just looking. I mean, if you look at the years where he's been, like, he was very active to now, it's before Oppenheimer, a little sporadic. Do you feel like sky's the limit for him now after this win?
Yeah, I mean, he can write his own ticket. You know, interestingly is that a lot of his sporadic work has been in Christopher Nolan movies.
Yeah, well,
Inception.
Yes.
Obviously, Batman ones. And he had a big role in Batman Begins, but then he had smaller roles in the two Dark Knight movies.
He was in both
of them, yeah.
I don't remember him being in all three. Definitely two.
He shows up as a judge in the Gotham in Dark Knight Rises, and he's at the very beginning of Dark Knight.
Oh, I didn't remember that. So, yeah, I just it's interesting how, like, a director like Christopher Nolan, who likes to use the same actors, he's kind of held on to that guy over the year, 20 years.
Right.
Oscar.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
An incredible job. Florence Pugh, she has a small but it's an important role, that Jean Tatlock. And I love, you know, the way that you, like, Jean Tatlock's suicide, which I don't know a lot about it, but it's controversial whether or not it was actually a suicide. But that's another shot that keeps coming back is, like, the dripping in the bathtub throughout this.
What do you mean it's controversial? Like, in real life?
They think
who killed her?
I don't know. Like I said, I don't know enough about it. I just know that there's alternate theories that say maybe that wasn't a suicide. Mm. But yeah, I mean, Florence Pugh is she's coming off now this and Dune 2. So
and Black Widow, of course.
Of course. Emily Blunt is great. I like how Emily Blunt in this movie kind of hides in the shadows and doesn't have a ton to do. And then when she comes on in the confirmation hearing in the last half hour and just runs these guys wild, it's such a great moment for her character.
Between the two of them, she has the spine for the...
Yes. Yeah.
And not that he doesn't... I mean, he just... I don't know what he's actually like. You maybe know more from reading his book. He just seems like kind of a nice guy. Is that how...
He's a complex man.
You said naive.
Yeah.
He seems like... just sort of a gentleman, just kind of going with the flow.
You know, it's part of what's so fascinating, where I do recommend the book, because the book allows you to... the two complement each other so well, because this is the film lets you feel his character. The book analyzes his character. So one of the things I think you get in the book is that the guy was very complicated. He could be this incisive politician, and obviously moved in high political spheres. And then he was capable of just being ultra naive and rolling over and being a martyr. I love the, you know, and it's a historical moment where Benny Safdie's character, I'm trying to remember his name, but he's shakes his hand after he lays him out to dry in the confirmation hearing. Mm-hmm. And then later Kitty refuses to shake his hand. That's historic. Both of those are historical moments.
Okay.
Another great small role. I know I'm jumping around. Do you know who played Truman?
No.
Gary Oldman.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I did not see that.
A one scene role totally disappears into it.
Young Han Solo plays a recurring character.
Anton Erla. I don't know his character's name, but he's the Senate aide for Robert.
Yes.
Downey
okay. Jr. That's what I was going to ask you. I didn't understand what role he was playing in the story, in the sense that it seemed like he was supporting Strauss, but also that he was anti-Strauss.
I think he was supporting Strauss, and then as he heard more of the narrative, was turned against him.
Okay.
You have Rami Malek shows up in this movie. Yeah, like, everybody's in this movie.
Just like another small role.
And, of course, Matt Damon.
Oh, yeah.
Matt Damon's so good.
My favorite actor.
Is he your favorite actor?
I mean, if I was put on the spot, I think I'd say yes.
He's really, really good in this movie. And I love in the confirmation, in the security clearance hearing where they ask him, would you clear Oppenheimer today? He says, no, but I wouldn't clear any of you.
Yeah.
Like, he's just so paranoid.
Right.
He's such a good character. And that's true historical. Another guy we were talking when we just recorded on touring, we were talking about actors who were big in the early 2000s and disappeared. Josh Hartnett.
Right. Although he's had a minor comeback. He was in something else recently that kind of brought him back into the public eye, but you're right.
Yeah.
I feel like that guy might actually be good, and he got lost in the romance movies he was in.
Yeah, he needs a Matthew McConaughey type recurrence.
You're right. Wait, wasn't it Christopher Nolan that kind of helped Matthew McConaughey get on
your
track?
So Interstellar and True Detective Season 1 came out, I think, in roughly the same time.
Yeah.
And before those, everyone was like, why is Christopher Nolan casting Matthew McConaughey? This is insane. And then True Detective Season 1 is such an intense role. He's so good in it. And then Interstellar, he's great in, too.
I haven't watched True Detective. I should. This is the second time it's come up in our conversations in the last few months.
You won't like aspects of it, but it's the first season's phenomenal.
Okay.
So the characters are great. The acting's great. Another thing I like, and this maybe goes into some of the editing, is the little surrealist touches in the film. Like when he'll be in the hearing and you get the bomb blast, the light from that. It's really well done how there's these subjective surrealist moments that keep coming up throughout the film.
I agree. That's why I feel very positive towards this film. Another thing that we talked in the last episode about how I come up with my star rating, another element of it is how rewatchable do I see this? Like, is this like 5? Like, I would want to watch this all the time. I don't feel bad about it. I feel very positive towards like what it achieved. Aside from the fact that it won awards, I could recognize great cinematography, great editing, great casting. But with those things in mind, it's not necessarily the exact type of story I want to absorb over and over again.
So I forget what I was telling you in the Troy movie that you should take out of your or boredom.
Yes,
you should
take boredom out. We recently reviewed over on the Patreon feed the movie Troy from 2004. And I talked about how feeling bored is an element of that I bring into as I'm one of the things I think about when I'm trying to give my ratings in a movie.
Yeah, and
so yeah, rewatchability, boredom. This is not, I mean, there's more things, but as a starting point.
Yeah,
so.
And boredom, it depends. Like, is that a valid thing? Well, are you watching a movie like, you know, you're watching The Rock's filmography? Mm-hmm. Okay, if you're bored in one of those movies, the movie's probably failing. But you could be watching a piece of great cinema that's trying to invoke boredom in you.
You're saying like Troy?
Yes, exactly like Troy. Like I've talked about this movie, Gene Dielman, which I think will eventually be one you watch in the Criterion Challenge. Very long movie. The movie has the intent of making you bored for getting at other things. So in my mind, it's a little disingenuous to rate a movie poorly when it's succeeding at the very thing it sets out to do. Mm-hmm. So similarly, I think you should take rewatchability out of it. And I was thinking about that. Like, there are great movies that you can't rewatch very often. Movies that impact you deeply that maybe you only rewatch once. And I was even thinking about this in the context of, like, my favorite film, 2001. I've rewatched a ton, but it's not my most rewatched Stanley Kubrick movie. You know, it'd be The Shining, probably. Like, rewatchability can be a factor. And again, maybe it goes to, like, I don't know. More pop culture movies are trying to get that too. But some movies don't have that. Like, especially a movie like this, it's a full meal. You know, it's a bit like saying, well, Thanksgiving dinner, I don't want to eat that every day. But McDonald's, I could go for that every day. So McDonald's is better than this carefully prepared meal. It's like, well, no, you can't have this every day because it takes a lot of time and effort and time to prepare and time to eat. And it takes more intention on your part. So, of course, you're going to eat something digestible, just quick and easy, more often.
I think that's a great analogy. I am receiving what you're saying.
Yeah. Okay. So I wouldn't hold rewatchability because I agree with you. This is not Christopher Nolan's most rewatchable movie. Totally agree with that. But that's different than saying, how great of a film is it? And I don't think he's come close to achieving anything like this.
Hmm. Okay.
So you asked me, I think when we were reviewing Dune, and we were preparing, I hadn't rewatched this yet. Maybe it was the Dune preview. You asked me which I liked better, Oppenheimer or Dune 2.
Yeah.
So here's the moment. And I'm going to answer it in two different ways. If I had to choose one, that would be the only one I could watch ever, I would choose Dune 2. If I was voting for one for Best Picture, I would choose Oppenheimer.
Okay.
I think it's the better movie.
So a little bit of a cheat, but that's fine.
It's I think it's consistent with what I've argued for throughout the life of the show. Separating the objective quality from your subjective preferences. I would choose Dune 2 to be what I watch, but Oppenheimer is the better film.
Okay. Wow. I hit the music on that one.
And I think by quite a bit, actually. And I love Dune 2. I'm not taking anything away from it. But
I feel like Dune 2 might be next year's best film of the year.
Could be. It would be great. Love Dune 2.
You think
Dune 2 is amazing.
Two genre film to make it at the Oscars? I'm talking about
probably
Dune,
but then, you know, I don't know, they gave it to Return of the King.
Yeah, but that felt like it was, that felt a little different, don't you think? That felt like they're like, well, this is for the whole trilogy.
Yeah. I don't know, it probably is. I don't, I would be surprised if it wins, but then again, I was shocked when Oppenheimer won.
All right, listeners, we both liked it. Ben a lot more than me, but I still liked it. And oh, I didn't mention this during the show, but did I mention this? Did I mention that I think that I'll like it more on a rewatch? Or did we just?
You did not.
Okay, yeah. Because of some of the things that we talked about throughout this episode, I think that having a better grasp of the full narrative and the characters and all, I think I'll enjoy it more on a rewatch. So, but even on the first viewing, 4 stars, really enjoyed it.
Kenneth Branagh is Niels Bohr. We didn't bring up.
Wow.
This is like, yeah, the all these scientists. Yeah. I just love Einstein showing up in this movie every now and then.
Not having a big role, but kind of a huge role if you think about that moment.
And that's a great thing Nolan does in this movie, is capturing those pivotal moments.
We didn't really talk about this, but did Strauss, he wanted the fame for himself? Like, was he jealous of Oppenheimer?
There's jealousy. There's a sense of, like, they keep cutting back to that moment where...
where he moves the flower pot.
Well, there's the flower one, but then there's also the thing where Strauss was wanting isotopes or something to ban export of isotopes. I forget all the things that involved. It's a real moment. And Oppenheimer embarrasses him.
Right. They said he embarrassed them, and he made the little joke, and everyone laughed. I didn't get...
So basically, what that moment was historically is Strauss was proposing this ban, and I don't remember all the details of it. And Oppenheimer didn't just argue against it, but he did it in such a charismatic, flippant way that he made Strauss look like a fool.
What job was Strauss offering to Oppenheimer in some of the early... interaction.
Yeah, so and this is where the chronology in the movie does get very confusing, is Strauss was at Princeton, and so Oppenheimer was at Princeton for a time, so that's where he met Einstein and all of that.
Because it felt like Strauss was working for the government.
Yes, he was, but they're a different context.
Okay, so I think I hear you saying he's working for the government first, later he's working for a college, and at the time he's working for a college, he brings...
Opposite.
Okay, so first he's working for a college.
Yes.
He brings Oppenheimer in to work there. Later he's working for the government, and he brings Oppenheimer again to the government?
Yes.
He's the one that keeps on recruiting.
Yeah, Strauss has this weird relationship with Oppenheimer where he kind of hates him, kind of loves him, kind of, you know, all of this. And I could be even getting the real-life chronology screwed up in my mind. It is confusing. But it's where I highly recommend American Prometheus. Really good audiobook too on it. Really, really well read. And you just get all these different aspects of Oppenheimer's personality.
All right. So think back a few years before this movie was a giant hit. People knew who Oppenheimer was, right? But I wouldn't say he's a household name.
No, I mean, you know the name.
Yeah,
you'd be like, which one was he?
Yeah. Yeah, if you're put on the spot, you could come up with who helped build the bomb and maybe even the quote that we often attribute to him, even though it seems like from this movie he read it somewhere else.
Yeah, it's from the Bhagavad Gita, the I Have Become Death, the Destroyer of Worlds.
So I was thinking about during this film, it's sort of interesting that he was not a household name because he changed the world, or he helped to change the world.
And he was at the time, like he was... you know, a celebrity.
So, maybe that's a different and more interesting question. Why, over not that many decades, has he moved out of that position?
And I think that...
like, we think of Einstein as, like, this is now... like, saying the word Einstein is, you know, code for genius.
Yes.
So why isn't Oppenheimer there?
I mean, it doesn't roll off the tip of the tongue. But no, I think... And this is part of what I think the book does a really good job. And again, the film gets you inside the emotion of it, but the book captures it as a historical moment, is that Oppenheimer's reputation had a really quick rise and fall. And a lot of that had to do, part of that was Strauss's character assassination of him. Part of that was, the shift from once the war ended and it turned into the Cold War, Oppenheimer's stance on the H-bomb project was very different than his stance on the atomic bomb, which the movie does get into a little bit, but that's...
Yeah, I don't even really know I don't know the exact distinction.
Bigger.
Yeah.
And so part of what Oppenheimer, where he opposed the H-bomb, is he saw that as an escalating, like if we research this, it's going to escalate the Cold War. He was probably right about that, and so he suddenly seemed like that was spun as an anti-patriotic, perhaps even pro-communist stance on his part, so he fell out of favor with the shifting politics. I think you also have to have that the legacy of the atomic bomb is, to put it mildly, a very complex one. If you think about the legacy, if you're living in, and I'm not saying this is right, wrong, or indifferent, but if you're living in World War II, and you have a lot of anxiety about how is this going to come out, and you perceive this as it helped us end the war, you're likely going to see Oppenheimer as a hero at that point. And then as time goes on and suddenly you get some of the evaluation of the horror of the bomb, suddenly maybe he doesn't look so heroic. And that reflects how he thought about himself, too. I mean, I love the scene with Truman, and it's allegedly historical that Truman offers him his handkerchief when he says, "I feel like I have blood on my hands." And Truman pulls out his handkerchief with this flippant response to him. That's allegedly actually happened. And so Oppenheimer goes from what you see him in the auditorium scene. It's like he is a deeply charismatic individual, or at least he can be. And he's embracing that. And he has this celebrity. He's on Time magazine. He's all of this stuff. And then going from that to realizing that he might be one of the greatest monsters in history. And he's himself, dealing with that. So what do you do as a culture when you have a figure like that? Is Oppenheimer a good guy or a bad guy? He doesn't fit into those categories. He's a very complex man.
So are you saying as we tried to forget about what we did to Japan, we needed to also forget about Oppenheimer?
Yeah, I think that, like, Einstein's easy. Oh, look at all the great Einstein-y things he did for us. Oppenheimer, it's like, maybe he won us the war. And we did that after I saw this first time. We saw it. We did that episode on the bomb and like the morality of that. And it's a very complex question of dropping the bomb. But just taking that line of argument for a second, you can make the argument Oppenheimer won the war, but at what cost? And so when you have a character who doesn't fit neatly into a hero-villain category, and all history knows how to do, at least popular history knows how to do, is put people into categories, it's easier to just let them fade into the woodwork of history. And I think the genius of this film is, from a character standpoint, I mean, there's so many things about this movie that just succeed so well, but from a character standpoint, it captures that ambivalence. Like, this movie isn't out to idolize Oppenheimer, and it's not out to villainize him. He's held up as a human being who participated in something, and what's that maybe he didn't even realize what it, you know, the extent of it at first, and he participates in this thing, and it gets beyond his control, and it changes the world. And what do you do with that? And what do you do with that when you're the person who built the bomb? And the movie just wrestles with those questions and doesn't try and force an interpretation on you watching it. Genius.
I forgot that we did that episode last August, so it might be a good follow-up to this episode. If you haven't listened to it yet, or if you did and want to re-listen to it, episode 1109, Seeing the Bomb with Ian, which is a play on our Seeing with Ian series. So we did an episode on the bomb.
We did.
So episode 1109. All right, listeners, that's all from here. I'm Matt Anderson.
I'm Ben DiBono.
We're the Sci-Fi Christians signing off.
Goodbye.